Welcome to Experts by Experience, the podcast series of the Irish Platform for Patient Science and Industry, IPOSI. In this series, we'll be looking at the subject of patient involvement in healthcare, whether that be in healthcare settings, policy making, or research. We'd like people to learn from examples and experiences of patient involvement from other countries around the world. In this episode, I speak to Elise Mabey and Amy Lang about the Canadian model of patient engagement, and more specifically, the Ontario model. The Ontario framework and practice of patient engagement is at a much more developed stage than Ireland. Patients can be involved at policy level, and there are even legal requirements for PPI in place now. Elise Mabey is a founding member of Patients Advisors Network in Canada. This is a not-for-profit organisation which acts as a kind of representative and support body for patient advocates and patient advisors. I asked Elise to describe the Canadian health system to an Irish audience.
So I was thinking about that and how best to sort of frame it for the Irish audience. So I thought I'd start with a couple of facts, and one of which is that the Irish population at less than 5 million is about comparable to the size of the Greater Toronto Area, which is the largest city in Canada. And in terms of landmass, the Canadian landmass is 142 times larger than Ireland. The province that I live in is 15 times larger than Ireland. So those are some of the challenges that we face in this crazy country of ours. And we have a federal system with 10 provinces and 3 territories. So we have, in fact, 14 healthcare systems in this country, one for each of the 10 provinces and 3 territories, plus the federal government manages a health system for the armed services and the national police, the RCMP. So it, in some ways, I think is more like the EU than it is like in any single country in that way. Our federal Health Canada sets policies and standards and then needs to persuade the provinces and territories to adopt them. Its leverage point, of course, is that it has tax dollars that it can give to the provinces and territories, and it can tie it to priorities, the latest of which has been mental health, and say, here's the money, but here's what you need to spend it on.
So that vastness of the country itself and then of the healthcare system that underlies the country, I suppose it poses challenges in terms of patient advocates themselves, in terms of exchange of information and peer-to-peer support. Was that really the impetus behind Patient Advisors Network Canada being set up?
In some ways, yes. It started, with a bunch of us in Toronto getting together and just enjoying each other's company and learning from each other about what made patient engagement work for us, how to handle the challenges. And we really enjoyed the support that we could give to each other. So then the question was, how do we, what about the rest of the country? Were there patient engagement happening in the rest of the country? And if so, how is that working for people?
Amy Lang is Strategic Advisor of Patient and Community Engagement at Ontario Health. She was formerly the Director of Patient Engagement at Health Quality Ontario. Ontario Health is a government agency that has absorbed a number of smaller agencies like Health Quality Ontario and various health authorities. I asked Amy why Ontario is much further advanced along that road of patient engagement. Was there a specific reason or impetus for that?
In Ontario, I think one of the reasons why we may be a little further ahead is that our system is actually quite decentralized. So you have hospitals and other healthcare organizations that are all off managing themselves. And what that has allowed, I think, is that some hospitals and other healthcare organizations were early adopters. They had the freedom to develop their own patient involvement programs. And I'm thinking in particular in Ontario, that those would be like the children's hospitals and the mental health hospitals, as well as our cancer agency. And so these programs were able to, they had the freedom to develop these really good patient involvement programs. And then other healthcare organizations were started looking around at them and saying, hey, that seems to be something that is working well. And so there was this sort of groundswell and kind of critical mass of organizations that started to adopt some of those practices. And then about 10 years ago, we actually had a bit of an acceleration in terms of our patient involvement in Ontario because a succession of governments actually passed legislation and regulations that explicitly mandated patient involvement in different aspects of our healthcare system. So requiring it in patient councils for our local planning agencies and in some of the quality work that goes on here, as well as developing a new patient complaints process and requiring patient and family involvement in the kind of review and development of patient complaints.
One of the initiatives we came across in Canada were the Spore Picky Networks. These are an initiative of the Canadian Institute for Health Research, and they're almost like a network of networks at a primary level. They're interesting in that they're a collaboration between health researchers, policymakers, and medical practitioners, and also patients are at the center of that. And now the work of those networks is actually beginning to inform policy setting at a primary level. I asked Elise maybe about the Spore Picky Networks to explain them to us and to tell us about her involvement with them. And one of the major projects that you yourself are involved in is what's known as the Spore Picky Network, which is very interesting because it focuses on the patient involvement in the primary care sector. And I suppose in Ireland, we're only getting started with patient involvement at a hospital level. So the idea of such an innovative approach in terms of the primary care setting was very interesting to us. Can you explain that network and how it works and what it does?
Well, I'll do my best. as I said earlier, the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, which are federal, initiated this strategy for patient-oriented research in 2011. And they set up what are known as SPORE support units in each of the provinces or regions of the country. So we have a bunch of those. But they also set up 7 pan-Canadian SPORE networks. 5 of those are disease-based, like on diabetes is one, some aspect of child health is another, and so on. But there were 2 others. One is Access Open Minds, which focused on youth mental health across the country. And the final one was the Primary and Integrated Healthcare Innovation Network, PICI, which is focused on primary care research, and particularly primary care innovation. There seems to be a real need here, and I think maybe elsewhere, to really rethink how primary care is being done, and particularly in the context, I think, of the changes that the digital world is bringing to every aspect of our lives. How can that enhance primary care? What are some of the new primary care models, integrated care and so on, team-based approaches? And how can we identify the best ones and spread them across the land? So that was the impetus for setting up the PICI, Primary and Integrated Healthcare Innovations Network. Bit of a mouthful. It's actually unique because it's a network of networks, because each of the provinces and territories has a PICI of its own. So I belong to the local provincial one as well. Okay. I think the other aspect of PICI, which is unique and is really important, is that it's fostering an alliance between research, policy, and practice. And I'm not so interested in research for research's sake. I want to see it implemented. So this really appealed to me. And each of the individual networks are co-led by a clinical, a research, and a policy lead. So you have the right mix of people at the table, and everybody is looking for something that is practical and implementable, but based on science and evidence.
So from your point of view, you know, what is working really well within that network? And then, you know, what hasn't worked to any great extent?
Well, I think that what's working really well is having the 3 stakeholder groups at the table in terms of the clinical people, the researchers, and the policy lead. Because research is not done in a vacuum. It needs, if it's going to be implemented, it needs to be implemented by the clinicians and by the policymakers. So having them at the table is a very, very, it's unique, and I think it's a very important piece of the equation. I would say that's working very well. In terms of patients and family members as being stakeholders, they have made a very concerted and growing effort to make sure that we are integrated. It's part of the SPOR initiative that we be integrated, but as you all know, we can be sitting at the table, but maybe nobody's listening. And in this case, I feel they are more and more listening.
And that's quite innovative, because I suppose patient voices are being heard in terms of the planning and forward planning for that sector. So it's often an add-on. So that's why we were really interested in the system, because there seems to be that patient involvement from the beginning and patient involvement in forward planning. Is that innovative in your eyes?
I think it is, but it is part of the SPOR initiative, which has been going now for almost six years. So I guess it seems a little bit more old hat. Having said that, the actual implementation of the ideal of having patients involved in the setting of research priorities, the description of the research problem, the application for the funding, the design of the research, and so on, is only really more recently becoming robustly manifest in any way. Some teams are further behind and some teams are further ahead. So I've had both the experience of being asked to tack on at the end and being deeply involved in helping to design the research right from the start. I will say one thing. I've also had the experience where the research design was done without me. And then in the implementation, they asked for my participation, which I gave, but I realized that the design was going to not bear fruit in certain ways, and it did not indeed, to the great credit of the researcher afterwards, when he was so disgusted with the results of the patient engagement. You know, he understood where that if he had involved me in the beginning, that design would not have occurred. It would have happened differently. And we wrote a paper together on that, which was published in the Canadian CMAJ, Canadian Medical Association Journal. And I've got to say, I was very pleased and impressed with the learning and the desire to do better on the part of my researcher colleagues from that point of view.
Now, Ontario Health is one of the few state agencies to have developed a framework for PPI. And I asked Amy Lang, who's now tasked with implementing parts of that framework, what is the value in having a framework for patient involvement?
The reason we thought there would be value in pulling together a framework is that as the quality agency, one of our jobs was to look around at evidence and best practice and kind of summarize it for the rest of the system and then put it out there so other organizations could use it. And so that's what we did with the patient engagement framework. We did a ton of engagement with patients and their families, as well as looking at the evidence and other best practices, and then tried to summarize it in a framework to say, here is what the evidence and practice tells us is the kind of goal of engagement, the ways in which you can do it, and the applicable domains in which you can do it. And we did that. We felt it was useful. And as I mentioned before, because some organizations had already been doing this for a while, we didn't want to impose this as a framework on all healthcare organizations, but we offered it up more as a resource or a tool for people to use in different ways, depending on where they were at in their evolution or their journey engaging patients. So for people who were just at the beginning, the framework we felt was a tool that would allow them to learn about what's possible and all the different ways they might engage patients and some of the evidence and reasoning for why you would want to do that. For other organizations, they could look at and assess their own patient involvement activities and identify where they were maybe very strong or where there might be gaps, or they might want to try to engage patients in a different way or in a different domain of care. And then we also saw it as a bit of a planning tool, because it sort of lays out comprehensively all the different areas where you might want to engage patients. It allows people to then use it to almost fill it in, say, okay, for direct involvement with patients, these are initiatives this year. For organizational or program planning, these are our initiatives. And then for governance and policy, these are our initiatives.
An important element of that framework for patient engagement was a requirement for the evaluation of patient involvement. But how do we measure the impact of patient involvement?
I'm wondering, you know, the importance of evaluating patient partnering or patient involvement. Is it improving care? Have you got examples of that, of how it is improving care? Or how do you measure that?
It's a great question, and it's really, I think it's a really hard question to answer. So when we created our framework, the evidence, it was kind of like we had puzzle pieces that we were piecing together. So there were a whole bunch of different studies, but looking at patient engagement in different areas on different projects. So it's not like you're able to compare one study to another, but taken together, the growing body of evidence was suggesting that there were real impacts when you engage patients in a whole bunch of different types of outcomes, from the kind of experience and satisfaction measures, which many health systems are paying attention to even patient outcomes, because when you engage a patient in their own care and they understand better what they need to do, they're better able to manage themselves as well. So that's at the individual level. And then at the program or service design level, typically we've got, again, kind of great examples or case studies of what happens when you do engagement well. You can redesign how a program works to create a better experience for the patient. And so there are lots of great case studies, I would say. Evaluation across systematically is a whole other story. It's something that we're working on right now. As so many organizations have now made engagement their standard practice, we're looking at ways for how can we assess more systematically across the entire health system the impact.
I also asked Elise about the impact of patient involvement from her perspective and her experience. And again, that same question I put to her, how can we evaluate that impact?
Well, that is an excellent question, because I'm most interested in, you know, the evaluation and the impact of patient engagement. And I'm involved in some research, large research projects that are looking to evaluate the value of patient engagement, which is long awaited for. But on a sort of more personal level, I've seen it in the different projects that I've been involved in. I've seen it with some of my healthcare colleagues whose point of view has shifted as a result. It's still a well-known secret, I guess, about the impact. Can I tell you some stories about individual impacts feel might be of interest? Well, one of the things that I did with a colleague in 2017 at the Quality Council here, which had 3,000 attendees, we were asked to talk about telling our patient's story. And we wanted to do something a bit different. And so we canvassed our PAN community and said, what is it about telling the patient's story that's important for people to know? And we found, to our surprise, it wasn't anything about the technique of telling the story. It was actually how to evaluate whether you should tell your story and how to refuse politely if you're asked and don't feel comfortable. So we did a role play that tackled those two things. One of us was the requester, usually a healthcare person, and the other was the patient partner playing herself. And interestingly, first of all, it was not a presentation, it was a role play, which was completely different from anything they had seen at any of these conferences. You don't normally do role plays at a conference. And second of all, we got approached by two or three people afterwards who said to us, I recognized myself in the requester, and oh my gosh, I didn't realize. So clearly, we had an impact in that way. So I think as patient partners, one thing we need to do is stay true to ourselves and think about other ways, not falling into the academic traps, but think about other ways of talking about the things that are important. So that's what I would say about that experience, which was a while ago. The other experience I want to talk about is a Beacon experience. Now, Beacon is the PICI network in Ontario. And with the advent of virtual care and digital and so on, they were doing research on patient or person-generated health data. So that's the data that comes from your Fitbit or your health, your heart monitor or your glucose thing, et cetera. It's usually a gadget or a direct input on the part of the person that then is used to measure something or to provide information about something related to health. So that's what PGHD is. Beacon approached myself and Pan and asked us if we would put together the principles for person-generated health data from a patient and caregiver lens, because it's very important that any of these things, as we develop policy, really develop policy with patients and caregivers in mind. So we did that, and in our final workshop with various stakeholders, we were approached by the health ministry personnel who attended that workshop, and they wanted to have the report right away. And they had meetings with us once the report was delivered and so on, so that they could incorporate it in the changes to the privacy policy that is coming up. That is a direct impact in a way that my researcher colleague said he has virtually never seen in his time as a researcher.
So if patient involvement has a real impact, how do we ensure we're doing it well? Amy Lang has come across some research which identified the three elements required for effective patient engagement.
And there's actually some research that some researchers from the University of Toronto have led on what actually, what kind of things or supports do you need in an organization to create effective engagement. And they've identified three things. One is leadership that is really supportive. Two is actually adequately preparing staff to engage. And that's something I've spent a long time doing, working with my colleagues, is making sure that they, you know, any concerns or fears they have are addressed, making sure they feel like they have the right skills in order to partner or engage effectively with patients. And then the third leg of the table is actually enlisting and preparing patients effectively. So two out of the three things that make engagement work well actually have to do with how you manage and develop culture and skills within your own organization, which is a lot of the work that I tend to be focused on. Some of the most effective work that we've been able to do in the various organizations is sitting down with program leaders and talking through what do they think would be the value of hearing from patients or families on their particular project that they're working on, and to share with them some of the possibilities or examples of what others are doing. And it's in those conversations that I've found you get people's imaginations fired up and can build some enthusiasm for trying something new.
We often find that, you know, in our work, that even, you know, one healthcare professional within a hospital who's committed to this can really drive initiatives as well.
Absolutely. And it's important at different levels, right? So having a healthcare professional on staff who's really committed to it can not just drive an initiative, but also be like a peer leader. Their peers are maybe more likely to sit up and take notice of what someone like them is doing. And then it's also important at the executive level to have leaders who will champion this and then commit resources to it.
Elise Mabee also spoke about her personal experiences of leadership and how it can benefit patient engagement, but also hinder it.
The other thing I've seen personally in my local hospital is when you have a change of leadership at the top, the culture of patient engagement shifts with the winds of whoever is in charge. And that could be for the better or it could be for the worse. I've seen both happen. So leadership and making sure that the leadership is deeply committed to patient engagement and understands its value and understands how it needs to be embedded. Those elements are critical to the change in culture, because culture won't change without that.
Finally, I wanted to talk a little to Alice about patient involvement in healthcare decisions during the COVID-19 pandemic. I wondered if Canada had fared better than Ireland, or if she felt that patient concerns and the patient voice had been largely forgotten in the response to the pandemic.
You know, patient organisations like ourselves have been pushing for, you know, digital health and telehealth. And now it's just quickened to pace and it seems to be being pushed through at a particular pace. But we're kind of wondering where the patient voice in that is, because telehealth is great in some circumstances, but for some patients, it doesn't work. And we need to hear those voices, don't we?
We absolutely do. And I'm currently on various projects because of my technology background and my deep interest in digital health and virtual care. I'm involved in a number of projects around the different aspects of it, particularly how do you deal with people who are deaf or can't see or don't speak English, which in Canada we have a huge population that doesn't speak English as a first language. First of all, we have two official languages in this country, which we, as I said, we have to account for. But then we have, we're a nation of immigrants, and we have a ton of other languages that we have to contend with. Any hospital, particularly in Toronto, will have to operate with translation or with actual people who speak a multitude of different languages. So how do you do virtual care in that circumstance? That's a big challenge, and I think it's one that we're still, you know, we're still in the early days of. COVID has definitely accelerated that here, although I will say because of our huge landmass and sparse population, virtual has been an element of Canadian healthcare to some degree for a while now, particularly when we look at the remote First Nations reserve, where if they're usually fly-in communities, they don't have hospitals. They very often don't have any medical personnel there at all. And so they do telehealth with the nearest hospital, which may be thousands of kilometers away. There has been a swing now to different, like COVID planning tables, opening up for sure to patient and family advisors and patient partners. And in many cases, they've realized, oh dear, we should really have involved you in the start because we have enacted visitor policies that have been harmful. And if we had involved you, perhaps that wouldn't have been the case. And so they're revising visitor policies all over the place now that we're being involved.
Yeah, and that's been echoed very much in Ireland and in the UK as well. One of the speakers at the conference in September, Carol Munt, is actually doing some research into that herself on an international level, just looking at, you know, what were the different policies in terms of visitors specifically for end of life also, and the kind of effect that has had, and carers not being allowed to visit their loved ones, and the actual knock-on effect that had on the health of their loved ones as well.
And it could have been avoided if we had been at the table and we could have put in place a slightly more nuanced visitor policy, such as the new ones that are being enacted now. It was helpful to really see, I mean, COVID has stripped away the lid off so much of society, and one of the places being the patient engagement place. So now we know that we need to embed it more deeply. In Ontario, the province that I live in, we have a law that says there must be a patient and family advisory council for the Minister of Health. It's in the law. So no matter which party is in power, they have to have a council. And that those are the small steps that will start to actually embed patient and family advisors.